From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. In the next couple of hours, subtropical storm Alberto is expected to make landfall on the Gulf Coast of Florida near Panama City. People are preparing for flooding and high winds as the first storm of the Atlantic hurricane season makes its way to the region. The storm could bring up to 12 inches of rain to the Florida Panhandle. Governor Rick Scott issued a state of emergency for all of the state's counties. Joining us now from Gainesville is meteorologist Jeff Huffman with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Hi, Jeff.
Good afternoon, Jeremy.
So is the rain the major concern with this storm?
It is. This is more of a nuisance event for nearly the entire state of Florida. There's only a small section of the state that'll experience more than just the heavy rain. And really, today, up and down the peninsula, not a bad holiday. We've got a lot of sunshine right now, especially east of the 75 corridor until you get to South Florida. But this is certainly a typical tropical storm where the hazards extend far away from the center. They're not real located right near the center, or they're not all located there. Also, it's more of a storm that maybe gets us a little bit in the zone or in the mindset of thinking about the hurricane season ahead. Of course, this is hitting early. But it's certainly more of a nuisance to most of the state than a severe event.
What about when it comes to winds? What are you expecting there?
Well, right along the coast there on the Gulf Coast, we already have tropical storm force winds being reported, basically generally from St. George Island near Apalachicola westward to about Destin. And it's right around Destin and Fort Walton Beach and near Panama City where the winds could cause some power outages. We're looking at maybe 40 to 60 mile per hour winds, probably more like gusts as opposed to sustained winds. That could certainly cause some tree branches to come down, maybe a few trees to come down, some minor structural damage. And that's going to be a concern right along the coast. The wind threat will not extend much further inland. This is a fairly weak tropical storm. But it's for a few select Floridians in those three or four counties there in the Panhandle. This is definitely more than a rain event.
Okay, well, now put your professor hat on for us and tell us, why is it a subtropical storm instead of a tropical storm?
Well, it is early in the season, so the water temperatures and the upper level conditions weren't completely favorable for what we would consider a pure tropical system. A tropical storm has a warm core. We're in the time of year where there's still a lot of colder air aloft and still a lot of upper-level dynamics that are more typical of a what we call a mid-latitude low that forms over the Midwest. So it's literally kind of like a, if you think of a hybrid car, it's kind of a hybrid storm system. It's in between the typical low pressures you get up in the Great Lakes in the Northeast versus a tropical system. And that's why – it's one of the reasons why, Jeremy, the hazards and the conditions with these type of systems are very complex. Thankfully, they're usually not as severe, but they are quite complex and they can extend hundreds of miles from the center.
Well, often with storms like this, the area that gets impacted the most is something that we weren't talking about at the beginning. And I'm wondering what you think will happen once this storm makes its way further north up into places like Atlanta or Nashville.
This is going to be a large and heavy, widespread rainmaker. And for areas that are already soaked and waterlogged, it could obviously aggravate flooding concerns. We're talking about a large territory, probably 10 to 12 states that will get at least a couple of inches of rain from this weather system. It's going to kind of merge with another system over the Ohio Valley. And basically a large swath from the southern or the southeastern Gulf Coast states all the way up into the mid-Atlantic states will see significant rain in the next 2 or 3 days.
Okay, well, that brings us to the other thing I wanted to ask you about, which is what happened in Maryland, in Ellicott City, flash flooding yesterday, dramatic videos of buildings and cars being swept away. Here's a clip from the Baltimore Sun of Howard County Executive Alan Kittleman speaking at an Ellicott City news conference yesterday.
I don't think I'm without exaggeration saying that this is worse than July 30th of 2016. I can just tell you my heart is broken. Thinking about what the people had gone through here, and the people's lives who were devastated 2 years ago and where they rebuilt, and now they're faced with the same daunting task again.
Now, what he's talking about there is in 2016, Ellicott City received 6 inches of rain over a 2 to 3 hour period, and on Sunday it got nearly 8 inches over a 6 hour period. What caused that, first of all, and do you think Alberto is going to bring more rain to Maryland?
Yes, Alberto can bring more rain to Maryland. It was more of a weather system and that kind of stalled with training of thunderstorms over some of the same areas. And we've had a wet pattern leading up to this as well. So it's just a reminder that these type of floods, and I know that area in particular is a little more prone to flash flooding. But this type of flooding can occur anywhere. The storm system that's in Florida right now, subtropical storm Alberto, will likely move in that direction. And forecast data suggesting we could have three or four more days where a significant rain could line up in certain areas. Not going to say it's going to be in the exact place there in Maryland that it just happened, but the pattern favors repeating rains over some of the same areas for a few more days from Florida all the way up into the Mid-Atlantic states.
It's meteorologist Jeff Huffman with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Jeff, thank you.
Always my pleasure.
More than 2.5 million children across the U.S. are being raised by grandparents or other relatives. That's according to Generations United, a nonprofit that supports these so-called grand families. Drug-addicted, mentally ill, or incarcerated parents are among the reasons why. Kathy Ritchie of Here Now contributor KJZZ in Phoenix reports on an organization in Arizona that is trying to help these grand families.
On a Saturday afternoon, families are streaming into a park in Glendale, a Phoenix suburb. The grills are fired up, and laughter and conversation fill the air, along with the smell of burgers. This is the annual Grand Families Picnic, hosted by Duet, one of the few organizations in Phoenix that supports grandfamilies. And it turns out there are a lot of grandparents who are acting like parents again. Take 56-year-old Marcia Sherman.
The hard thing was switching from grandparent, where you spoil your first grandchild, to now you, the parent, you're in a different role as far as you have to be disciplinary, and you can't be the spoil them and send them home because they don't go home.
Sherman and her husband Brian started taking care of their grandson when he was 2. He's now 13.
There were a lot of things we had to learn, like car seat 101, as far as car seats had changed. A lot of things had changed. Getting back into daycares, diapers.
Like a lot of grandparents here, this was not in the plans. They'd raised their kids, but their daughter was addicted to methamphetamines. She was going to jail, and their grandson had become a ward of the state. So they decided to adopt him. Here's Brian.
It is what it is, you know. He's my son, and I'm going to do the best I can to make sure he grows up to be a good man. That's it.
Victoria Gray and her husband raised 9 of their grandkids. They took in their first grandbaby in 1993.
You find yourself at PTA meetings, and you're 40, 50 years old, and everybody else is in their 20s, and you're like, I'm here for PTA. And the children had different things, like kids were teasing them, like, why is your grandmother here all the time? Where's your mother?
Their granddaughter, Dejanera Nichols, is 15.
I felt embarrassed when I was little because I didn't have a mom or a dad to take me to my dances, my PTO, my parent-teacher conferences.
And that's what makes an event like this all the more important, says Patricia Dominguez, the director of kinship services at Duet.
We are just about ready to get started. We will have, there's some free plays for the kids.
And I often hear them express how great of a time they have with us because they're not having to explain where mom is or what's happening, why do they live with their grandparents.
And what's happening, says Dominguez, is addiction.
Right now, meth and heroin are the top two choice drugs of choices.
Patricia Taylor's 3-year-old grandson was born addicted to heroin. He spent 17 days in the hospital. Taylor, who's 67, has had him ever since.
It's harder physically. It's less hard mentally, I think, because I know more about children and I've learned from my mistakes.
You can hear regret in Taylor's story.
I'm providing quite the structure for him, whereas when I raised my daughter, Dr. Spock had a book that said, you know, don't hurt their feelings, and I didn't provide a lot of structure for my daughter, and I think that's part of the reason she ended up like she did.
Besides wanting to get it right, so to speak.
All of us in this group worry about surviving long enough to be able to raise them. You know, that's all of our biggest fears.
Another fear, says Denise Bodeman, who's a principal lecturer at Arizona State University's School of Social and Family Dynamics, is the return of the parent.
Because many of these children are there, not legally. They're just there. They are off the books.
Bodeman says it's estimated that for every one child that's in the foster care system and living with a grandparent or relative, there are 20 others who are not in the system. So two things. The grandparents may not have any legal rights, and the number of kids living under those circumstances could be much higher than reported. When we look at all of the issues related to this, it's easy to say, well, it affects a small percentage of Americans, but...
It affects every one of us. And when we look at all the issues related to grandparenting, financial is up there. It costs them money.
According to the nonprofit group Generations United, more than one in five grandfamilies live below the poverty line, which could mean relying on public or private agencies for things like food or beds. Some grandfamilies tap into their retirement to make ends meet. There's also the trauma many of these kids experience early in life. Again, Duet's Patricia Dominguez.
You've got maybe defiant behavior, separation anxiety. It's those trust factors. For some of the grandparents, the anger are some issues.
And these issues don't just go away. Being a part of this modern family that's emerging in large part because of the opioid crisis means more resources are needed, not just for the addict, but for their families who are literally picking up the pieces. For Here and Now, I'm Kathy Ritchie.
Tonight marks Game 7 of the NBA Western Conference Finals. The Golden State Warriors will play the Houston Rockets, and the winner of that game will go on to face the Eastern Conference champions, the Cleveland Cavaliers, which beat out the Boston Celtics 87-79 last night. LeBron James dominated once again, leading the Cavs in scoring with 35 points. In a press conference last night, James compared the ups and downs of the season with Ohio's Cedar Point, the self-proclaimed roller coaster capital of the world.
I guess this is the last chapter for our team in this season. It's been a whirlwind. It's been Cedar Point. I'm sorry for you guys that don't know much about Cedar Point, but it's been a roller coaster. And it's been good. It's been bad. It's been, you know, it's been roses. It's been thorns in the roses. It's been everything that you can ask for. And I've always said this has been one of the most challenging seasons I've had.
There is another big game tonight, Game 1 of hockey's Stanley Cup Final. The Washington Capitals are playing against a first-year NHL team, the Vegas Golden Knights, made up of cast-off players from around the league. They won a stunning 51 games in their inaugural season, and Las Vegas is going wild with its newfound pride, now hoping for the cup. It is Memorial Day, the unofficial start to summer, and that means a lot of grilling and barbecuing. Kansas City has a rich barbecue history and more than 100 barbecue restaurants. We were there in October and checked out Jones Barbecue, a small place on the side of a highway in Kansas City, Kansas. It's run by Deborah and Mary Jones. We started with a lesson in KC barbecue from Jill Silva, longtime local restaurant critic.
There's lots of great barbecue out in the world, but of course we're the best, and that's because it all kind of comes together in a melting pot in Kansas City. So we have beef, which is our primary meat, and that comes from our stockyard traditions. However, we do like pulled pork, and we do like...
Burnt ends,
you know, well, that is part of the brisket, of course. Yeah, so... Those kind of come together. We also have different woods here, so we're really into hickory and oak with a little bit of fruit wood. So then our sauce is very tomatoey. Got a little note of molasses in there, but we're also open to vinegar and mustard and even Alabama white sauce now and again.
But maybe not as much vinegar as the Carolinians.
Not as much, no. But I mean, we're ecumenical. We'll try a lot of different things, but we know ours is best.
How many restaurants serve barbecue here?
Last I heard, it sounds like we're around 100.
And I have to say, since we've been here, everybody's got their favorite KC barbecue restaurant. We've heard about Gates. We've heard about Jack Stack. We've heard about Joe's.
Joe's KC. Right.
So what's your favorite?
That's like asking somebody to choose their favorite child. It just depends on what you're looking for. I mean, there's great personalities behind the pits. There's also great food. Some are legacy restaurants, some are new, some have full bars and dessert, and others, you know, barely considered the sides. It's all about the meat.
How often does somebody who lives here eat barbecue?
Wow.
Is it a special occasion, or is it like every week you go out and have barbecue?
Nah, well, I guess it depends on the person, but it's not a special occasion. I mean, we get the meat sweats after a while. We need to eat our meat a certain amount of times. But, you know, I think it varies from person to person.
And when was barbecue introduced here?
Well, the furthest back that I've read is Henry Perry. He was African-American. He worked on the riverboats that came through. So that would have been probably in the mid-1800s. And he decided he would start a barbecue cart. And from there, Kansas City became known for barbecue.
What do you do in Kansas City if you're a vegetarian?
Well, we actually have a new vegan place called the Peaceful, I think it's a cart actually, it's called the Peaceful Pig. There are also some restaurants in town who do charred jackfruit, which is a tropical fruit that you can smoke. So there are some options. I think a lot of the more modern restaurants are actually trying to make sure that if a group of people wants to go out and socialize and they have a vegetarian in their group, that there is definitely something on the menu for everyone.
Now, our listeners can probably hear some of the wind around us right now.
Yeah.
What they can't smell is that we're standing right next to the pit here, and the smoke is probably going to be part of our clothes for the next few days. But
yes,
it smells incredible.
Yes, hickory and oak is what Deborah uses, and her pit's really, really interesting. For your listeners who can't see it, it's actually a secondhand kind of pit that's out in a parking lot. And she's got a little fence around it, and she sits out here in the elements and does her barbecue. And I really give her a lot of credit for coming here day after day, no matter what the weather is, and doing what she loves.
As you can see, we still do a lot of the old, we still do, you know, old school. If you would have came earlier, you would have saw a big fire. Right now, we just want to keep everything, you know, nice and warm.
Deborah Jones loads logs into the pit. She and her sister Mary run this place.
Well, the way I got started was my dad first just taught me and my sister how to barbecue. Told us it was something that maybe might come in handy one day. So we said, okay. And I kind of stayed with it more so than anybody. And that's how I got started.
And how long has this been here?
We've been here about 3 years.
3 years?
Yes, sir.
And where were you before that?
We started at 1805 North 10th Street. That's where we started in 1987.
So what kind of things are you barbecuing?
We barbecue beef, we barbecue pork, we barbecue ribs, we barbecue rib tips, we barbecue chicken, ham. We make our own sausage and we barbecue those.
And are the recipes the same as they were from when your dad was running it?
Yes, sir, from the beginning. Yes, they are. The sauce, the beans, and the sausage are still the same. Mm-hmm.
And what's your secret? Why do people love this barbecue so much?
I think it's because we still do it a little bit on the old school. We still use actual hickory and oak mixed instead of using the, you know, the gas and starting it up that way. We actually just start our fire from the beginning. You know, throw the chips of wood in, the bark off the bark of the tree and crisscross it and stir it up and get our fry started.
How important in creating the flavor that you're going for is the wood that you're using?
I think the wood got a lot to do with the flavor because we don't use no rubs and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
I think that because a lot of people will get the meat and just get the sauce on the side because they just like the smoke flavor. Uh-huh. And the wood, the hickory wood, we cook more hickory than anything. And I think that is what really sets it off.
Tell us about working with your sister all the time. How's that?
Oh, me and my sister, we love each other to death. But we have differences like anybody. But at the end of the day, we still sisters. Anybody tell you that, they'll see us arguing and having a difference. Oh, that's all time. And it don't mean anything.
You argue in the kitchen?
Oh, yeah, all the time. We argue in the pit. Yeah, we all go outside. It don't make no difference. But at the end of the day, we still sisters.
What's the hardest thing to make?
I think the hardest thing to make is the sausage because it's a lot of time consuming with the sausage. Uh-huh. The sausage is time consuming. You got to first cut the meat, then you got to season it, then you got to grind it, then you stuff it through the casings. Yeah, that's the longest procedure. Yeah, the sausage.
Now, you're two women, obviously, two African-American women.
Mm-hmm.
it sounds like a lot of the owners of barbecue restaurants in this area are men, mm-hmm. and even many white men. What does that say to you? Or is there a difference between your backgrounds when it comes to the barbecue you're doing?
Well, it might be a little bit different for his background, but basically, as I'll tell anybody, it was just our dad taught us a lot of things besides barbecuing, how to lay carpet, you know, towel, different things, how to fix doors, because he just said, you never know, you may have to do something, get through life, and he just always told us to learn as much as you could. But as far as it's dominated by men or whatever, when we came along, we didn't look at it like that. We were just looking at, you know, our daddy teaching us things in life on what to do.
What is it like now to be a woman in this industry?
You know, it being men dominating the barbecue field don't bother me one bit. You know, I can fit in with them. You know, I have no problem with it.
Do you think that you bring something that they can't?
Well, of course. I always bring something. The fact that I'm a woman, that right there says a lot. And the fact that, you know, I know how to barbecue too. I ain't gonna say I'm the best, but I can stand toe to toe with some of them or any of them. You know, it don't bother me.
Inside the tiny kitchen of Jones Barbecue, there's a book about barbecue, and in the back, a photo of Deborah Jones and her sister Mary, much younger, and dressed to grill. This is you and your sister.
Yes.
What does that mean to you? Because that was not in this place. That's
where it all started. That's where our daddy trained us.
This is where you were trained?
Yes. Uh-huh. On 10th.
What do you think when you see that photo now?
We just laugh. Uh-huh. We laugh.
Why do you laugh?
Because we look back at then and look back now. I mean, and then we write up to now and we say, well, we've come a long way.
Yeah.
We've come a long way.
Deborah Jones of Jones Barbecue in Kansas City. We also spoke with Jill Silva, then with the Kansas City Star back in October. You can find photos of the delicious food and that photo we were just talking about at hereandnow.org.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Planet Money tip number 17. A great analogy doesn't have to make sense.
Busier than a one-legged bobcat covering up his own crap on a frozen pond.
Did you just make that up?
Well, yeah.
Planet Money, a poetic podcast about the economy.
Italy's president has appointed an interim prime minister, a technocrat and former official at the International Monetary Fund. The man who was supposed to have the job, Giuseppe Conte, failed to form a government over the weekend. Conte was tapped to lead a coalition between the populist Five-Star Movement and the anti-immigration party, the League. But Conte's plans unraveled when the president rejected his choice of economic minister. Joining us now is Danny Eberhard, Europe editor for the BBC. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Jeremy.
So these two Eurosceptic parties have been trying to form a coalition government after their election in March. Why did the Italian president have to intervene?
Well, the Italian president has a constitutional role to approve both a designated prime minister and also a cabinet. This after a long period of wrangling between the League and the Five Star Movement, they eventually came up with a joint candidate. The president approved him, but he did not approve one of the ministerial choices. Now, the key figure here was a man called Paolo Savona. Mm-hmm. He's an 81-year-old economist known for his Eurosceptic views. He does not like the euro and feels Italy ought to have a backup plan to pull out of the euro if it can't force change within Brussels, the wider European establishment.
So by putting in a technocrat and rejecting this government, which was, I guess, Eurosceptic, Does it tamp down any of that anti-Europe sentiment that we see in Italy, both on the right and the left?
Well, this is one of the key questions. It's a risk by President Mattarella. He basically said, as guarantor of the Constitution, he couldn't pick someone who had expressed his skepticism over the euro. Mr. Mattarella felt that it sent the wrong signal to the markets and financial uncertainty in a country such as Italy, which has a colossal debt load. So now he's nominated Mr. Cottarelli, who's a former official with the IMF. He's someone who's known for preaching the doctrine of austerity. He's a fiscal conservative. He's expressed doubts about the economic program proposed by the anti-establishment parties, which included massive tax cuts and also a massive increase in public spending. Now, the danger in him being nominated is that he won't get parliamentary approval for his proposed program. But if he gets voted down, what will happen is there will be elections after August. And both Five Star Movement and the League will be campaigning heavily on that basically they're being kept from moving into power and that the voice of the Italian people has been thwarted by the president.
And you're joining us from London. Is there worry in the rest of Europe that Italy could actually, at the end of all of this, leave the EU?
Well, Italy is a founding member of the European Union, and currently it's not looking to leave the European Union. But the campaign, the election campaign that there's likely to be, Europe will become more centre stage than the last election, which was held in March. In March, the biggest issue was the issue of migration. This time round, Italy's relationship with Brussels is likely to be more centre stage. Now, we're not yet at a situation where Italy is planning to leave the euro, but it just increases the temperature of that particular debate.
That's Danny Eberhard, who is Europe editor for the BBC World Service. Danny, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
People are visiting cemeteries across the country on this Memorial Day. One of them is, of course, Arlington National Cemetery, where today President Trump placed a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. The president also spoke to the crowd gathered near the tomb.
We are gathered here on the sacred soil of Arlington National Cemetery to honor the lives and deeds of America's greatest heroes, the men and women who laid down their lives for our freedom. Today we pay tribute to their service, we mourn alongside their families, and we strive to be worthy of their sacrifice.
President Trump speaking at Arlington National Cemetery today. The Tomb of the Unknown Soldier dates back to the aftermath of World War I, a conflict that claimed more than 115,000 American lives in just 19 months of fighting. Here and now is Alex Ashlock, met with the author of a new book about the unknown soldier at Arlington National Cemetery.
After the carnage of World War I, nations that had lost millions of service members were looking for a way to honor those dead. They found a simple concept with powerful symbolism: the remains of one unidentified soldier buried with honor to recognize the service and sacrifice of the many. An unidentified French soldier was buried under the Arc de Triomphe. Britain interred its unknown in Westminster Abbey.
And then here in the United States, a woman editor of a very famous publication at the time, The Delineator, Marie Maloney, decided to send a letter to the brass that something needs to be done to honor our men.
Patrick O'Donnell is author of the new book, The Unknowns, The Untold Story of America's Unknown Soldier and World War I's Most Decorated Heroes Who Brought Him Home. Soon after the war ended, New York Congressman and combat veteran Hamilton Fish introduced legislation that called for the return of an unknown American who had been buried in France to be reburied in the United States. Again, author Patrick O'Donnell.
It was in Chalon, France, that four bodies, unknown bodies from four of the cemeteries that were the major fighting had taken place in the American Expeditionary Force were selected. Unknowns were selected. They were very carefully checked to make sure that there was nothing in there that could identify who these men were. And the burial tickets were actually burned after the bodies were selected. And the four bodies were selected and then brought to Chalons, France, and put in the city hall there.
A sergeant from Chicago, Edward Younger, was given the honor of selecting from the four unknowns. Only one would be coming home.
And he's sort of the quintessential doughboy. This is an individual that fought in many of the major battles right outside of Belle Wood at Vaux, for instance, through the war at a place called Blancmont, which was kind of like, think of the guns of Navarone. It's this incredibly fortified position, which for years the French could never take. And the 2nd Division, which Edward Younger and the Marines in the 4th Brigade were part of, were able to seize Blancmont in an epic struggle. But Edward Younger finds himself there that night, and he's given the honor to select the unknown soldier. And they hand him a bouquet of flowers that morning, a bouquet of roses, and said, please choose the individual. And he walked into the room where the sun was starting to come in and just felt a presence that one of the men in one of the caskets was somebody that had fallen beside him. And he laid the flowers down on the casket, and that is the unknown soldier that's buried here.
Once selected, the unknown soldier started his final journey.
They bring him back to the United States on board the USS Olympia, which is, you know, this storied warship that Admiral Dewey had. The Olympia brings it back. It comes into the Washington Navy Yard, and the body bearers, the eight men that are in this book, bring back the remains. It first goes to the Rotunda, Capitol Rotunda, where he lies. There's, you know, thousands of Americans that see him. And then the procession comes down from Washington to here in Arlington. And, you know, initially Pershing was supposed to be on horseback, but he just wanted to be a regular mourner and walked behind the caisson with the unknown.
Pershing was General John Blackjack Pershing. He was commander of American forces. The eight body bearers were among the most decorated Americans who fought in World War I, including two Medal of Honor recipients. These men carried the casket to the tomb site in Arlington National Cemetery and stood with thousands of other mourners for the burial service.
This was an incredibly important event in 1921, on November 11th. This was a chance of healing. Everyone was in, you know, many of the leading organizations, the NAACP, the, you know, many folks were invited to this ceremony. And one of the things that I found really interesting is it was the last person, as the unknown was being placed in the tomb, was Chief Plenicluse, who was a Crow war chief, was given the honor of placing his warhammer on top of the tomb, and he says several words where, you know, even says later on that education is your greatest weapon. But it's part of the healing process of, you know, for many, many years we fought Native Americans, but, you know, this is a chance for them to come together. And one of the body bearers, Corporal Saunders, was also a Native American, a Comanche, and one of the most decorated Native Americans in the AEF.
Patrick O'Donnell there talking about Thomas Saunders, who was born in Medicine Bow, Wyoming.
Saunders is extraordinary in the sense that he is in charge of, he has to breach the wire. He has to, with wire cutters, he has to go out and breach the wire so that the infantry can go through. Otherwise, they would just be destroyed by the machine guns. And you know, single-handedly goes out, this sort of forlorn hope, to a suicide mission and breaches the wire at a place called San Mihel, where the Americans have an offensive. And he's deep behind the lines, German lines, and, you know, quite extraordinary. Captures single-handedly over 60 German soldiers.
Among the other body bearers on that day in November 1921 was Army Sergeant Samuel Woodfill from Indiana. He was a Medal of Honor recipient, a man General Pershing described as one of the greatest American soldiers of the war. There was also a sailor, James Delaney of Boston. He spent 15 months in a German prisoner of war camp. And Ernest Jansen, a Marine who earned the Medal of Honor for his actions at Belleau Wood. On Armistice Day 1921, these body bearers stood at attention beside the casket of the unknown soldier before it was lowered into its final resting place.
So all these years later, the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier is just one of the most hallowed places in the United States. It's, you know, I don't, millions of people probably visit this area every year. What does the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier mean to the U.S. in terms of military history and just history in general? What does it mean to, what does this place mean?
This is hallowed ground. It's sacred ground. The Tomb of the Unknown Soldier represents all who served and who've have fallen for the United States.
The white marble tomb of the unknown soldier stands atop a hill in Arlington National Cemetery that overlooks Washington. On the east panel are Greek figures representing peace, victory, and valor. There are also six wreaths, three on each side. Those represent the six major military campaigns of World War I. On the back of the tomb, the side you see if you're visiting Arlington, are these words: "Here rests, in honored glory, an American soldier known but to God." For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlaw.
Tomorrow is May 29th, or 529, and a number of states have turned it into a day to draw attention to 529 education savings plans. The plans allow you to put your money away for college and save on taxes. And the new tax law Republicans passed allows the money to go toward not just college, but also K-12 education at religious, private, and charter schools. Jill Schlesinger is a business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. She's now a Gracie Award winner. Hi, Jill. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So, okay, let's talk about these plans. How do they work and what are the benefits?
Well, it's kind of a cool thing because a 529 plan is a tax-advantaged savings plan. And it was originally constructed to encourage families to save for future college costs. They're sponsored by the states and they're authorized by the Internal Revenue Code. And the cool part about it is that you put the money in. There's no tax benefit to put it in. But as it grows, there's no tax due. And as long as you pull it out for what's called qualified educational expenses, there's no tax on the accumulation. It's amazing, actually. I sort of like to think of it as almost like a Roth IRA for education.
But since they're administered by the state, do the benefits vary based on which state you live in?
Yes, and that confounds so many people because they say, well, you know, I live in New York, but can I use the Rhode Island plan? You can use most of these plans, but some states offer very specific benefits for residents of that state. So, for example, using New York, that plan is a plan that offers a state income tax deduction if you use the plan. So it really behooves someone who lives in a state where there's an extra little bonus of a state tax deal to use the state's plan.
So if you put money away in a 529 plan, is that going to reduce the amount of money that you could get later for financial aid for college?
It is a great question. So yes, it will. When you have a money that's in there, you're going to reduce your aid amount, but it is usually at a fairly low rate. So if it's held by a parent on behalf of a kid, you're usually seeing a reduction of 5.64% of the asset's value. So if you saved about $10,000 in a 529 plan for your kid, her aid would be reduced by roughly, say, $550 or so.
Jill, we mentioned the Republican tax law changed these plans to include K-12 education at religious, private, and charter schools. Some have called this a giveaway for wealthy Americans. Tell us more about that.
Well, you know, as I said in the beginning, these plans were constructed specifically around college.
Right.
And the way that they started was that there were some states who were trying to figure out a way to prepay college. And there was then an expansion of these plans. And then with the new tax bill that went into effect for 2018, you can now withdraw funds, as you said, to pay for K through 12 education. The reason it's called a gift to the wealthier Americans is that it's considered sort of this sort of elitist thing. You're sending your kids to a private school or a charter school or a religious school. If you're saving money for that, boy, you must have a lot of money. It's not necessarily the case. There's plenty of people who are doing this, but the benefits of a 529 plan have always skewed to the wealthier Americans out there who are using them because, frankly, so many people can't even save money for their retirement, let alone their kids' education.
And are all states signing on to these changes to allow the plan to be used for schools other than college?
Yeah, this is a real wrinkle because you can pull up to $10,000 a year out, but it's predicated on whether your state conforms to the new rules. So again, 529 plans require a little bit of research. There's some good information on the SEC's website, sec.gov, or the FINRA website. Don't pull the money out to pay for your kids' private school bill before you check with your state.
Now, if you put this money in to pay for college and then your child doesn't go to college, what happens? Do you get penalized for taking the money out?
What happens is that the money that's not used for your qualified higher education expenses or not used at all at this point will be then subject. You pull the money out. Now you're subject to the state and federal income taxes. Plus, they're going to whack you with an additional 10% penalty on any earnings. That's really to make up for the fact that if had you just invested this money in a regular old taxable account, the government would get to dip in and take a piece of your earnings. That said, this is a really great plan for families with multiple kids because most states will allow that if Jeremy is, you know, a concert violinist and gets a free ride somewhere, his sister Jill can then use the money that was in his account.
One more thing I want to ask you about on this. There's a 529 account that many people may not be aware of for Americans with disabilities. It's the 529 ABLE account. What is that?
So this is kind of interesting. These accounts were established to provide families with kids or grown adults, actually, with disabilities, the opportunity to save up to $15,000 per year in a tax-deferred account. It's similar to a 529. It's a way to supplement government benefits without penalizing the family for having this money saved on behalf of the kids. So there are some folks who see this as a way to kind of avoid having to set up some onerous trust, and it can be very useful.
Jill Schlesinger, a business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Jill, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.